This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, welcome back, Crossover, NBA podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. What up, Beck?
What up, Mannix?
Great job this week with our friend Howard Bryant on the Friday version of the podcast. I listened to that during my long scenic ride up to Vermont, where I like to just bury myself away for days at a time when city life gets to be too much. But I listened to the podcast. It was terrific. Great conversation with you and Howard.
Appreciate it. Yeah, the only thing better than listening to one Howard on a long drive through the Vermont woods would be two Howards. Happy that we could make that pass by for you. I'm glad that we are that podcast episode could be as relaxing and as tranquil as the Vermont woods themselves. So you're welcome.
All right, so no trip to Vermont for me this weekend, but I do have a flight. So what will I be listening to on Friday? What's coming up this week?
That will be on the Friday edition of The Crossover. I will be speaking with one Thad Young of the Chicago Bulls. Really looking forward to that one.
All right, that should be really good. All right, on this episode, though, Howard, we're going to get into the Clippers and their ability to make a miraculous comeback. Chris Paul, what a season he's having. What a postseason he's having. What does that mean for CP? And did the Milwaukee Bucks just get as lucky as any franchise could possibly get with the injuries now being suffered by the Brooklyn Nets? We'll dive into that as well. And got a guest this week, Howard. Colin Sexton, the guard for the Cleveland Cavaliers. He's going to join me for a conversation about what he's seen during these playoffs as well. But with the playoffs, Howard, in full swing, of course, we're going to start with the Lakers and what's going on with LA this offseason. For that, we bring in another really smart guy, which again should be the, got to find some like, you know, audio for this part of the show, like a really smart guy, something like that. Somebody to sing it for us. But we're going to bring in Dan Wojcicki, does a great job covering the Lakers for the Los Angeles Times, talk about everything going on in a busy already Lakers offseason. What's going on, Dan?
I can't think of anything more Lakers, by the way, Chris, than like outlining all these like things that are happening in the league and then kicking off the show by talking about the Lakers offseason.
Well, I like, mean, it's
perpetually what I deal with, by the way. It's like,
I mean, they're the most interesting team still in the NBA. Like you can't.
Yeah.
There's never a bad time, I think, to talk about the Lakers.
And this is why fans of every other market hate the national media.
I know.
You want me to call Josh Robbins and get him in here to talk some magic right now? Magic off season? Like you want to go deep down that rabbit hole? Love Josh, but I'm not sure there's the same level of interest in the next head coach of the Magic as there is the off season with the Lakers. So, Dan, sure. I want to jump in to I think where I want to start is kind of all the drama with Jason Kidd over the last week. And we'll get into the Lakers and their roster and all those issues, but I was fascinated by the Jason Kidd situation. I mean, Damian Lillard comes out and says, I want Jason Kidd to be my coach in Portland. Jason Kidd subsequently comes out and goes, you know what? I don't think I'm going to be the head coach in Portland. I'm going to take my name out of consideration. You've covered the Lakers for years now. You know Jason Kidd. Like, what did you make of all that?
I was a little confused, Chris, to be honest. And I'm still not 100% sure exactly sort of what it all means. I think, you know, obviously when Frank Vogel took the job and part of the job was predicated on Jason Kidd being on that staff. I mean, my first reaction is like, I mean, like the Lakers have hired not just their current coach, but they've hired their next coach too. Right. Was sort of and I was not the only person who thought this. This was a pretty, you know, widely held sort of assumption. But over these two seasons, when you talk to people about Jason Kidd and sort of the role he played within the Lakers, not only as somebody, you know, obviously who held the respect of LeBron James and Anthony Davis because of his on-court play. I mean, this was they played together, Jason and LeBron, obviously in the Olympics. But also as just sort of a guy who learned how to be a coach, right? We talked to Frank Vogel a couple times here after they lost, and I asked him about Jason Kidd specifically, and he talked about how like Jason Kidd was just in addition to becoming like, you know, a close friend of Frank's and a confidant, but also somebody who like learned how to do the work, you know, and Chris, you know, Frank embraces the work, right? Like this is a film room guy, true and true. And I think hearing him talk about how Jason would handle scouts and handle, you know, the pregame sort of like walkthroughs and stuff like that, it was eye-opening. And then you hear this thing happen and you start to wonder like, well, you know, Frank's in the last year of his contract.
Mm-hmm.
We asked about extensions and everybody said the right thing, but it's one thing to say it. It's another thing to do it. What's actually happening? And I think it's a fair question. It also maybe speaks to some uncertainties about the stability in Portland too. It could mean a lot of different things. And I think that's kind of why it's so interesting. And that's why it's more interesting than anything else that's happening in the NBA. And that's why we're leading the show with it.
Yeah. I mean, to me though, let me just like, I felt watching that whole thing play out that this was Jason's way of kind of taking the Lakers' temperature on elevating him to be head coach. Like, for all those reasons you mentioned, Frank being last year of his contract, a disappointing finish to the season, though no one can blame that on Frank Vogel. Like, it's injuries that derailed that team at the end of the season. I felt, and I don't know if you had any, I mean, you kind of alluded to a little bit, but like, I felt that this was Jason trying to see if there was a pathway to him getting the Lakers job. Because, you know, if the Lakers thought there was at least a chance that they could lose him to another team, would they be proactive in that sense? And which we've seen in the NBA before, like, would they be proactive and move Frank out to move Jason in? Did you have any inkling of that?
I mean, the thought crossed my mind, but I mean, I think also too, it just, and look, man, weirder things have happened in this league for sure. But like, how dirty would that be? Like, considering like the job Frank Vogel has done with this team, like it is, that is dirty, dirty business. And, you know, you have a coach who won an NBA championship, who helped shepherd your team through unthinkable tragedy, through unthinkable distractions. I mean, like that year was a forever year that really didn't even end until they were eliminated by the Suns. I mean, you can go back from them being on a plane to China while Daryl Morey's tweeting about Hong Kong to like till a week ago and view it as one continuous season and think about the job that Frank Vogel did having that Laker team attack the regular season, that's first year with the team, to still somehow having the best defense in the league, you know, this year as they dealt with tons of injuries, dealt with players in and out of the lineups, having things kind of thrust upon him and having to change styles multiple times. And it's just like to send that guy walking now, like it, I mean, the world's not fair. That would be really, really unfair, I think. And
but do you think they extend him?
It would be a bad precedent. It would be a bad precedent.
Do you think they extend him?
Do they or should they? I mean, I think they should. Yeah.
And I mean, yes, positively. Yes. And I love Frank Vogel, but the guy won a damn championship. I mean, absolutely. He's the right guy to coach that team.
Yes. And look, and I mean, again, this is like, and Howard, I think, can speak to some of this too, as somebody who's been around, like this does kind of start to bleed into like the Lakers' weird financials too, sort of where it was like, you could just extend him. And then if you have to fire him and pay him to go away, like, you know, that's what you would do. But like the Lakers aren't like the most liquid team in the world, you know, and they just went through a year in which, you know, they never had more than 6,000 people walk through the gates of a building that they don't even own. So it's like, you know, now look, they've got plenty of money through their TV deals, but they're also staring down a huge tax bill potentially this year if they decide to kind of run it back, is whatever that looks like. And so is that part of the calculus? I don't know. They're in a fascinating position. You're right. It's a super interesting offseason because so much common sense says, like, you were in a really good position before Anthony Davis grabbed his Achilles, right? You were still in a pretty good position before Solomon Hill, you know, dove into LeBron James's ankle trying to get a steal. And, you know, injuries happen, and that's that you ride that out. But like, how different do you need to be How different, like, what's your appetite for change? Because the vibe that I got, you know, kind of coming out of the season was that, like, they felt pretty good about their talent level. It's not like they need to get a lot more talented. They kind of, I mean, look, they'd like to shoot the ball better, be a little more efficient on offense, but, like, that was a team, like, and we saw it in games two or three against Phoenix, is like a really good defense, a dominating defense. And there's no reason to suspect that they wouldn't be for a third straight year if they kind of come back.
Well, that's, I think, all true. And I understand when Rob Pelinka in the exit interview day says we have a championship roster. And listen, if LeBron and Anthony Davis are healthy, mm-hmm. I don't think any of us disagree. But they weren't healthy. And the drop-off to the next tier of players they have is steep. And a lot of the guys that we were all praising them for picking up in the offseason didn't exactly deliver. Yep. So let's take it from there. Let's assume a full season of health by Anthony Davis and LeBron. Are we still sure they have enough, Dan? And if not, where are the places where you think they are most vulnerable and maybe even have some regrets about who they swapped out?
I mean, I would say yes. I mean, I've been under the belief that, like, healthy LeBron, healthy Anthony Davis is just good enough for, like, the last 2 years, to be honest. Like, that's been sort of like that those players are special enough and impactful enough on both sides of the ball that it kind of elevates everyone around them. Right. That, like, if you have competent role players, like, you'll be okay. Right. Now, what was super interesting, Howard, about their offseason was it seemed like they tried to hedge against that sort of notion a little bit by, like, you know, let's take a little bit off their plate offensively. Let's go sign Dennis Schroeder, who is, you know, while pesky on defense for sure, is a guy who could get a bucket. Let's go sign Montrezl Harrell, who is not pesky on defense. Who sort of exists to play with energy and get buckets. Like, let's try that stuff. And quite frankly, in an effort to kind of, like, if those guys miss some time, whether it's, you know, 2 weeks with COVID or an ankle sprain or just sort of like the bumps and bruises that were sure to come with that, you know, shortened off season, that they would have, you know, guys sort of in the wings ready to take on bigger roles. And it just never really materialized. That identity never really settled that way. Like, there were flashes of it occasionally where, you know, you could see sort of what they were trying to do. And I think that team performed admirably enough, especially on defense. Like, it was never an issue of playing hard or anything like that. They always pretty much played hard for the most part defensively. But, you know, I think the Harrell signing was a miss. I don't think there's really any question about that. This was sort of their big free agency guy, the move that they had to make, right, was they had their mid-level exception. They gave it to Montrezl Harrell. And, you know, by the first round of the playoffs, he's not in the rotation. Like, that's not good. You don't want that. and then I think secondarily with Schroeder, you know, it was a guy who had a pretty good season, shot the ball poorly from three and was out of the lineup with, you know, COVID-related stuff twice for big extended chunks, played through some injuries when he was around, but just, I don't know, had a couple really dreadful games when they needed him to be impactful with Anthony Davis hurt. So, I mean, the Lakers know all of this stuff, but it's sort of like, well, what do? You're capped. I mean, you're paying LeBron James and Anthony Davis, you know, $70 million next year. What do you do? Like, when you have two superstars, like, bird rights matter. And the guys who you have bird rights for, like, that's how you keep your team sort of functioning. And so are you kind of stuck with Dennis Schroeder? Like, even if you don't think he's a perfect fit, like, I think you might be.
Yeah. I mean, I guess one question I would have about Dennis Schroeder is, like, does Magic Johnson's opinion matter at all within the Lakers at this point? I mean, Magic had those comments about Schroeder where he said, I don't think he's a Laker. I mean, I wonder how, you know, Magic has no power anymore, but does that influence anyone over there?
I mean, I think he's so closely to having power and that organization is so sort of small in a way that, like, yeah, I think, I mean, that gets noticed for sure. I mean, I think it's like, you know, present to Magic Johnson a list of alternatives and let's discuss them. I mean, like, they are paying, you know, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. I have it here in front of me. Hold on a second, let me pull it up here. You know, they're going to pay $41 million to LeBron next year, $35 million to 80, 26 combined to KCP and Kyle Kuzma, And you know, you've got a player option for Montrezl Harrell out there around $10 million, and you've got Marc Gasol under contract, which who knows, you know, if he even wants to come back sort of after the way that went down last season. So it's like, I mean, your role players and sort of your big money guys are kind of already spoken for. So it's like, unless you think you can use that mid-level and hard cap yourself again to go sign a starting level point guard, I don't know how you're doing better than Dennis Schroeder for a player that's going to make $9 million next year. Is Kyle Lowry going to take the mid-level to come be your point guard? I don't think so.
Well, this is something I wonder too, and it's a point I've made a couple times, and Laker fans don't like this point, but part of the quandary for the Lakers is that they just don't have any assets left because they got their butts beat at the negotiating table on the Anthony Davis deal. And we can always say, well, they got the championship and that justifies everything, but it doesn't. I've said this, I wrote it at the time. They won the trade, they lost the negotiation. And they gave up so many assets in that deal when they should have had all the leverage in the world that they just don't have much left. So if you're Rob Pelinka and you're trying to get creative and you're trying to find, like, they're not going to find a third star. They're not going to get, if there's a Bradley Beal sweepstakes to be had, I don't think it involves them. I don't know where else they go in terms of more around the edges, but is there a plausible path forward if we agree that at a minimum with LeBron getting another year older, you need a little bit more room for error. You need another, you know, shot creator scorer type when he's on the bench or if he's going to miss some time.
I mean, in-house, like the best option is sort of betting on the continued development of Talen Horton-Tucker, which will be a bet that they will make.
As a restricted free agent. So first they got to resign him.
Yeah, they're going to. Yeah. And look, and I think, again, we mentioned bird rights and all of that stuff. Like, he's a player that they have bird rights to. So they can go over the cap to resign him. And because they have virtually no room under the cap, like, they will fight to keep him. They have made it clear that they will fight to keep him. He was part of the reason why, you know, they didn't actually pull the trigger on a deal with Toronto to add Kyle Lowry, right? Was how much they value him and how much LeBron and Anthony Davis think of Talen Horton-Tucker, who just totally coincidentally has nothing to do with anything, is also represented by Clutch. Totally irrelevant. But so, I mean, I think, but like, we, you know, you saw flashes of it definitely late in the preseason. And then kind of throughout the course of the season, I think when they kind of gave him the keys to a rotation spot, he was very inconsistent. But you do watch him, and you saw it in the playoffs a little bit, aggressively getting downhill, aggressively getting into the paint. He's got a really funky game as a get-your-own-basket type of shot creator. If he can become, he's a good ball handler for a player his size. He's got really, really long arms, which make him kind of an interesting sort of potential defender. He's very green. You know, he has value around the league as a trade piece. But again, like, all this stuff, Howard, like, not to get all super, like, Larry Kuhn on everybody, like, this stuff is all, like, has to get the math. Like, even if you wanted to trade for Bradley Beal, like, getting the 30-some-odd million dollars for them is tricky. Like, it's just not – it's not an easy thing to do. That trade starts with KCP and Kyle Kuzma at $26 million. That is the foundation of that trade. You know, if Montrezl Harrell opts in. So those are the three pieces you have to make the math work. I don't think that's palatable for Washington. I would guess not. And like, look, and if you want to trade the draft rights to some 7-year-old right now, which is like sort of like those are the first round picks the Lakers have to trade, you know, or you're just every year that comes by, they get one more draft pick in 2029 that they can try to move or something like that, that, you know, and you lightly protect that, like, that might get you into some conversations. I don't think it gets you into a superstar now conversation when there are other teams out there that are also on the precipice of winning, who need to make moves, who have better assets. It's just you're in a weird spot, so you have to be smart, you have to be creative, you have to develop in-house. And I think we saw this with like some of those Miami Heat teams later. Is like, you just have to hit on your vet minimum guys. That's sort of the path you go down when you have multiple max players. Like, you got to get your exceptions right, and you got to get your minimum guys right. And if you don't do that, your roster construction is going to probably be screwed.
And I think there's a reasonable argument to make, Dan, that that's, you know, bringing the band back together is the right way to go. I mean, before these guys got hurt, they were top three in the Western Conference, and nobody was betting against them.
They were first, weren't they?
I don't know if
second.
They were ever. You know, I had this, somebody in the league office texted me that when I think I wrote that once, they're like, no, they were third or something like that. Whatever they were. They were like 23 and 6
or something like that.
They were great. And look, you're always a little bit worried about regression when it comes to LeBron. He'll be in what, the age 37 year next year. Mm-hmm. You're always going to be worried about Anthony Davis because he's proven fragile at different points during his career. But a lot of teams have those concerns with injury riddled players. And with those two guys, plus you bring back Schroeder, Kuzma, like the pieces that are already there or that you can bring back without having to, you know, reinvent your roster. I think they're good enough. I think they're still good enough to be a championship level team. Now, I don't know what happens with Andre Drummond. I have no idea what that market looks like in the next few months. But, you know, even without Drummond, I still think that this team with minor tweaks, and I still think they'll be a team that could lure in, you know, one of those ring chasers at some point in the next offseason. I just don't know that there's a reason to overreact to what happened in the first round. I think it's disappointing for sure, but, you know, the window hasn't snapped shut, I don't think, on this Lakers team.
Chris, it's funny you say that. So one of the things that, I mean, we've covered, all three of us have covered teams that have been eliminated in the playoffs. And look, doing this stuff over Zoom, one of the biggest changes, I think, all of our jobs is like when you add that buffer between people, like it's harder to like get a feel, like just like sort of like that subconscious feel for a situation. You don't know the teams as intimately as you do when you're around them physically every day and chit chatting and such and such. Anyways, when teams get eliminated, right, it's usually like a pretty like somber, morose kind of thing, right? Like it's your season's over. It's sort of like, it's not like the last day of school. It's all the sad parts of the last day of school, right? Like people are going to go their separate ways. Like this team is going to disband in some fashion and it'll be different the next time they reconvene. I didn't get that vibe from the Lakers so much as I got maybe a little bit of a sense of relief. Also, like, look, they knew. They saw Anthony Davis walking around. They knew LeBron James's ankle wasn't what it needed to be. They knew he could, you know, he obviously could not and or did not kind of have sort of like the Luka Doncic, Donovan Mitchell, Damian Lillard type of like ability to just go score 55 and you know, I'm doing it that way. That wasn't there. And they also knew kind of what they were before all of this stuff. Like this Lakers season was so interesting because so much of it happened sort of in imagination. You know, where like the entire year was sort of predicated on the projection of what they could be if and when they were healthy. And it really only flashed for a couple of times. But I mean, again, go back to the end of game three against the Phoenix Suns. The Lakers up 2-1. Jay Crowder ejected. Devin Booker ejected, right? Like the Suns like being ripped apart by this like sort of realization that the Lakers defensively, like they have not been able to score against this team. And look, tons of credit to Phoenix for responding to that, you know? But like the Lakers were in control of that series. You talk to people around the league who are watching the series, like that, to say it was over is a stretch, but like the Lakers were in control of that series and Anthony Davis hyperextends his knee, you know, and plays through it. And because he's favoring that knee, he sprains his groin and the series is over. It happens quickly. And now look, 2-1, Chris Paul was armless also, by the way, like that should also be pointed out at that point too, that like he was not a fully functioning basketball player either, but those were the breaks. So, I mean, I tend to agree with you. I mean, to me, it seems sort of like the smoothest path is to do that. And look, and if you want to take Kyle Kuzma and use him as a piece to get a more proven shooter, you could maybe do that, you know, that seems like an option, or something like that. If you think you can get a player who's maybe not as effective defensively as Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, but who's a little bit more consistent of a scorer, and that's what you want, you know, KCP is a young player on a pretty decent deal. Like maybe you can get that done, you know, with sort of one of these future picks or something like that. But like trading for Bradley Beal or trading for Damian Lillard or any of these sort of photoshops that show up in my mentions every time any player anywhere in the NBA speaks, like it's going to be tough. I don't know how they would do it unless it's some sort of, again, complete on I'm only going to one team and I'm only signing there kind of tampering palooza type of a
that
situation.
Never happens.
I don't know how
tampering never happens in this league.
Never. Definitely not the Olympics either, in case all those guys show up there. So So you know.
Nope, we're not going to the Olympics. We're gonna be on the. It'll happen at the red carpet of the Space Jam 2 premiere. That's where that.
You think LeBron would consider the Olympics?
No, right. He said no. I mean, no? Did you see? Yeah, I asked him, and he took that moment to talk about Lola Bunny, Chris. It was, again, this happened the night they were eliminated from the playoffs. Like, yeah. This is where the headspace was in that. Like, it was not like, boy, you know, I need to, like, we just lost. I need some time to think about it. It was like, I'm spending my summer with Taz, with Tweety Bird, with Lola Bunny. I'll see you on Jimmy Fallon. Was sort of like the gist of the post game.
All right, so we'll confirm no Olympics for LeBron. There we go. Yeah. Just wondering if he would consider making a return.
I don't think anybody's signing up for 3 more weeks of a bubble. By the way, on the Lakers, I think that's
yeah. That's another part of it too. As I was checking in on the even just the Vegas part of all that of the thing. Not going to be the most enjoyable of experiences. I don't think for anyone that winds up. Going out there. Should be a good offseason, though, Dan. Lots to get to with the Lakers. Thanks. Thanks for taking some time to join us.
Thanks for having me. I look forward to talking to you guys about the Lakers offseason between games 4 and 5 of the NBA Finals.
Thanks, Dan.
All right, Howard, let's keep it in Los Angeles with the Clippers. We're recording this on Monday afternoon, so we don't know the outcome yet of game 4 of this series. But for the Clippers to advance in the playoffs, they're going to have to do what no team has done in the postseason, that is overcome back-to-back 0-2 deficits in the first couple of rounds. The Clippers did it against Dallas. That Mavericks team, a little bit flawed. Not much more there besides Luka Doncic. This Jazz team, a lot better. But this Jazz team is banged up. Mike Conley has been injured. We saw Donovan Mitchell go out towards the end of Game 3. So handicap for me, the Clippers' chances of coming back from another 0-2 deficit.
I'm not about to predict another Clipper comeback from 2-0 down, in part because I've got too much respect for what the Jazz have accomplished. But it's on the table, Chris. Like, the Clippers can do this. So, you know, any doubts you have about a team and its makeup, its capabilities, especially when faced with that kind of adversity, are fair until they overcome them. And we just saw it. Now, the Mavericks are not the team that the Jazz are. But coming back from 2-0, and then they had 2 straight elimination games, right? They're down in that series 3-1. They've got or 3-2, whatever it was. They've got to win 2 elimination games just to get out of the first round. You can look glass half full, glass half empty. Was that an indictment that they were ever down in the first place against a team that's not as talented as they are? Or is that just a sign of their resiliency? I think it is a sign of their resiliency because they did come out of it. And yeah, this is a Clipper team that's flawed and gets itself into holes and has guys disappear at inopportune times. Thinking of you, Paul George. But they have found some things that work along the way. Their small ball lineup, which saved them against Dallas and which has been pretty effective against Utah and has made Rudy Gobert's impact diminished. It's working. So, you know, is it going to take Kawhi Leonard going supernova as he did in the closeout games against Dallas? Quite possibly. Is it going to require Paul George to actually play like the top 10 player that he's supposed to be more consistently? Yes. They don't have a lot of room for error, and the Jazz are really good. But they've got the defensive players, Kawhi in particular, to go mess with Donovan Mitchell and try to slow him down. They have the ability to turn this thing. But I'm not about to predict it. And again, a lot of that has to do with the Jazz. And Utah's possibly getting Mike Conley back somewhere along the way here. And that will, you know, lend them a new playmaking dimension too, which could tip the series.
Oh, the Conley recovery is critical to this Jazz kind of puzzle. But I after watching Game 3, Howard, I'm somewhat concerned about the health of Donovan Mitchell. Because Mitchell, you know, when he went out in that fourth quarter, it wasn't over like a fresh ankle twist. It was over the impact on landing. And when I saw that, I'm thinking the Clippers probably also saw that. And they heard Donovan Mitchell say, it impacts me when I land. The ankle injury suffered, the nasty one that cost him a bunch of games during the regular season, still impacts him when they land. So I'm Ty Lue. I am pressuring Donovan Mitchell on the perimeter as much as possible. If it's double teams, fine. But if it's just one-on-one play, I'm going to make him get to the basket and make him start to think about that injury and make him start to think about what could be coming if he goes up hard and lands. Make him take uncomfortable shots. That's sort of what I took away from the Mitchell injury. Obviously, you got to have Conley back and fully healthy. You got to figure out some things with Gobert to make him more effective against those smaller lineups. But the way Conley landed and the kind of pain he was in, and if it was a closer game in game three, I think he would have gone in or gone back in. I think Quinn Snyder made the decision that, look, we were already down 10-plus in the fourth quarter. Like, let's just live to fight another day. So I don't think it was a crippling injury. But the fact that he re-injured it or tweaked it, whatever it was, just by landing, that made me a little bit concerned about his health the rest of the series.
Well, yeah, and especially if they don't have Conley, right? Then you're running out of ball handlers and initiators. You know, Joe Ingles can do some things. Jordan Clarkson obviously can do some things. But no, this team is not going anywhere without a healthy Donovan Mitchell. And if he slowed up a little bit, it's going to make it that much easier on the Clipper defense. But also, you know, the Clippers, they have a lot of guys to throw at Donovan Mitchell. Paul George can take him at times. Kawhi can take him at times. You've got Reggie Jackson. You've got another long guy in Nicholas Batum, you know, another multi-positional type defender. Pat Beverly, Terrence Mann. I mean, they've got the ability to really throw a lot of players of different shapes and sizes at Donovan Mitchell. All the more reason why it's just critical to try to get Conley back if they can. It's obviously not in anybody's hands, right? You're ready when you're ready. You're ready when you're cleared and when you feel you're ready to go. So I'm not saying to rush it. I'm not saying to force it. But it feels to me like at this pivotal moment, and again, we're recording this hours before game four, Clippers down 2-1. But if they can grab this one and it's a tie series, suddenly this is more of a coin flip. Something like Donovan Mitchell not being 100% or Conley coming back and being able to stabilize them some could be what tips this thing.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see exactly who's able to stay on the floor for the Jazz the rest of this series. All right, let's talk about the other team in the Western Conference, that being Phoenix, coming off the 4-0 sweep of the Denver Nuggets. A lot of things that were impressive to me about the Suns, Howard. But Chris Paul, his performance in that game four was remarkable. And it got me thinking about kind of the totality of Chris Paul's career. Now, he was putting up bigger numbers in his early years with New Orleans, in his prime years with the Clippers. But I watched Chris Paul play, Howard, and you can make an argument that, like, this is his most the last few years, or at least couple of years, have been his most impactful years. Like, he goes to Oklahoma City, a team that just traded away Paul George and Russell Westbrook, and he gets that team into the playoffs as the number six seed, pushes the Rockets to seven games in the first round in the bubble. Now he goes to Phoenix, which no doubt, as we've talked about, was a team on the rise and has them cruising into the Western Conference Finals. Not to say he couldn't have done this when he was younger, but there's just something about Chris Paul now as he enters kind of the, I don't even want to call it the twilight, because that implies like this might be only one or two years left. It might be 3 or 4 years left of Chris Paul playing at this level, which is a separate conversation. But I've really been impressed with, you know, the season's not over, but these last 2 years in Oklahoma City and in Phoenix, in my mind, two of the finest seasons of Chris Paul's career.
They are, because of the context, right? The context is everything. And there's a difference in this league between being a young star who everything is riding on your shoulders versus a veteran who, because of you know, maybe some physical limitations or slowing down a little bit, you're now in more of a facilitating role. And it's not that he can't, like, he obviously leads in 1,000 other ways. Chris Paul never has had to lead strictly with scoring, nor has he. But he has the ability, as we've seen, to, you know, uplift the guys around him, stabilize, lead, you know, just kind of raise these guys up, right? We saw it in Oklahoma. The only recent blemish, of course, I mean, people can go back and talk about the Clippers, but I mean, in the last few years, which is the time frame we're talking about, these latter years where you thought he was fading into the sunset and his contract was being viewed as untradeable and all this, Houston is the big, you know, misfire, but that's not even about him so much, I think, as it is about the team and Harden and a partnership that just wasn't going to work. But what we saw in Oklahoma was incredible, a team that had no business being anywhere near the playoffs, and he gets that team, you know, in there and could have potentially even won a first-round series. And then Phoenix. Yes, they were on the rise anyway. Yes, 8-0 in the bubble meant something. And Booker and Ayton and Bridges and these guys, they were ready to take another step. But I mean, Chris Paul is the linchpin that, that gets them forward. And then there's the numbers on top of it. So this is what he just did in that four-game sweep to remind folks. He just averaged 25 and a half points. That alone, at his age, 20, I mean, for a guy who was never considered like a big-time scorer, 25 and a half points, 10.3 assists, steal and a half per game, only a little more than a turnover, 1.3 turnovers per game, shot 75% from three, low volume, but still, shot 63% overall in the series, and made all of his free throws in the series. That was the second round for Chris Paul. Just incredible. I mean, I don't know what more we could say about him. I do think it's interesting, though, while we're sitting here praising him, and rightfully so, Chris Paul has not been a beloved figure. Like, of all the guys in the league right now who are locks for the Hall of Fame when they're done, Chris Paul's been viewed as annoying. You know, he's been viewed as controlling. He's been viewed as, you know, just really tough to deal with, right? He's a tough love kind of leader. And that hasn't always gone over well with teammates. Hasn't gone over well, you know, his demeanor on the court has gone over well with opponents. And some of the, you know, some of his play, some of his physical play, some stuff that people thought was borderline dirty. He hasn't been real popular with the referees because he's constantly on them. This is not a cuddly figure overall, but in his twilight here, Chris, I think we're going to appreciate him in a different way because of his leadership and his toughness. The bond that he's got with Monty Williams is something else too. It's cool to see him in a different light, and it's great to see him, given his career resume, have the opportunity now finally to be in a conference finals and possibly an NBA finals.
Oh, you mean Chris and Scott Foster aren't exchanging Christmas cards every year?
It goes way beyond Scott Foster.
I know, yeah. I know, but that's the most high-profile dissension that he's got with. Maybe it's a case where he just needs the right kind of team around him, where you look at these last 2 years, he's surrounded by young guys, impressionable guys that, you know, grew up probably worshiping him in a way, that he was their role model. Goes to Phoenix, another team, young guys, impressionable guys. Like, the last couple of years, he hasn't really had any... I mean, Devin Booker is great, and all-star, MVP, fringy candidate, top 20-ish, whatever you want to call it, but very young guy. He hasn't had... Like, his problems have arisen. And look, the Clippers, you do have to own the playoff failures in a way there. That some of that is on Chris Paul as well. But he had, you know, issues with kind of guys that were his peers, whether it's Blake Griffin or DeAndre Jordan. You go to the Rockets and his issues with James Harden, his peer. None of the guys the last couple of years have really been peers of his. He has been kind of the old hat that they've sort of looked up to. And I think that's kind of helped the dynamic a little bit. It's created a nice balance in that locker room because of who Chris Paul is and who his teammates are. So that's why I think, you know, this is looking a little bit too far ahead, but, you know, I don't know what he does with that contract. He's owed like $44 million in the player option. Bobby Marks, who we both know and are friends with, he tweeted at me, said it's more likely that Chris opts in and then takes a two-year extension with Phoenix on top of that at like $20 million per year. That makes a lot of sense to me. But regardless of the money, staying in Phoenix makes all the sense in the world. Chris Paul has found a situation that works, a situation that probably is going to be sustainable over the next few years, where Devin Booker and DeAndre Ayton, who is another topic altogether, he has been excellent. Both these guys are really looking to Chris Paul for leadership, and he's providing it.
No question. And just to go back to my last point for a minute there, obviously he did make one conference finals. I was, you know, as I was saying, you know, finally make a conference finals. What I mean is finally make a conference finals worth a realistic, I think, path to the finals as opposed to just making one. He did make one. They were facing the Warriors. His injury obviously factored into that. His injuries have often factored into his postseason failures, if we want to call them that. He's also had his miscues. I can't remember which series it was with the Clippers the year where, you know, all the fourth quarter, late minute gaffes, turnover at the baseline, all that stuff. Like, he has contributed to some of his own postseason demise, but he, you know, there were a lot of things that just didn't go right for those Lob City Clippers, right? You know, including, of course, being, and then again with the Rockets, being in an era with a super team at Golden State. That's one that no matter how good you were, maybe you just weren't, it just wasn't going to happen. And this is different. I agree, there's no reason he should leave Phoenix. Like, this is where he should retire now. He's got a coach who you know, he's got a bond with going all the way back to their New Orleans days when they were still the New Orleans Hornets. and, you know, that it goes beyond playing. That's beyond player coach. That, as we heard from them last night, that is about friendship. That is about a bond and a reliance on each other that they went through, obviously, when Monty Williams had great personal tragedy and Chris Paul was there for him through that. And so why would you leave that coach? Why would you leave, you know, he's got a home, I believe, still in LA. You're a quick hop from there. You're not going back east. You're not going somewhere else. And you've got a team that is showing right now, no matter what happens in the conference finals, the Phoenix Suns being a young team. This is not like with the Lakers, we're talking about, like, what changes do they need to make? Can they make changes? The Suns arguably don't need to do a thing, Chris. You can always, like, go get another star potentially if there's the opportunity. But the Suns are young and still evolving. DeAndre Ayton has room to just keep getting better. So does Booker. So does Bridges. So does Cam Johnson. They, you know, as long as Chris Paul can stay healthy, and he is up there in years, like, this is going to be a big wild card for them overall the next few years. As you're charting out how big is Phoenix's window at the moment, should be really long because most of their cast is really young. But there's a really key piece in Chris Paul who's older. So how much longer can he be this version of Chris Paul? Not the question for today, but it's the question for the Suns, you know, in the big view. But I love what they've got, and they, you know, they would be, I think, probably the most easy to embrace team out of the teams left in the West for the general fan who doesn't have a rooting interest otherwise.
Yeah, and when you're talking about durability, Chris Paul, and this has been written before, but he did make some changes in those final years in Houston to his routine, to give himself a little more pliability, to try to avoid some of the injuries that plagued him. And in back-to-back years, he has been an Iron Man, basically. 70 games each for Oklahoma City and this year for Phoenix, shortened seasons, both of them. So he's, you know, you're always worried about the durability of a 36-year-old, but I think he's shown signs that and throw in the fact that his game doesn't require a lot of athleticism. Like, he's not some hyper athlete like Russell Westbrook or somebody else. I think his game will age pretty well. And I think he's going to be a big reason that Suns team is really good for years to come. Let's finish quickly on the Milwaukee Bucks and the Brooklyn Nets. And about a week ago this time, Howard, we were talking about the Nets looking great, playing great basketball. James Harden, Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, they look great in that Boston series. Then Harden goes out in the first minute of game one against Milwaukee. Miraculously, the Nets recover to win both those first two games. Game four, you see Kyrie Irving go down with a pretty nasty-looking ankle injury. I mean, Kyrie walked out of the arena in a boot. I don't know about you, Howard, but I've never seen a player return quickly that walked out of an arena in a boot, so I'm expecting Kyrie Irving to be out for the foreseeable future. Now the Nets are looking at potentially finishing this series, if not longer, without Kyrie Irving and without James Harden. So as great as Kevin Durant is, I don't know how you win a series like that. I don't know how. I mean, does Durant have to go for 60 plus for them to get a win? It probably comes down to Bruce Brown and Joe Harris and the handful of other role players stepping in and making plays. But against this Bucks team, I just don't see it. I don't see how, you know, is Durant's greatness is undeniable. I just don't know how they do it.
Yeah, and if people are going to start going to, like, the regular season stats of here's how KD did without Harden or without Kyrie or without both of them and all this, like, okay, that's fine, but that's the regular season. You're not playing the Milwaukee Bucks night in, night out to try to win a playoff series. So, yes, Kevin Durant can do a lot, and he's a great playmaker too. He's not just a scorer. He can get guys involved. He can draw defenders to him and create open shots for his teammates, all that. There's a lot he can do, but it's asking an awful lot when you don't have a single other reliable scorer next to him. You know, replacing, you know, it's one thing to have Harden go out and all that playmaking and scoring go with him, but then Kyrie also, and now you're down to, yeah, you know, Mike James, who just, you know, just found his way to Brooklyn 6 weeks ago, whenever it was, and Bruce Brown, Landry Shamet, you know, Blake Griffin has been a revelation of sorts in Brooklyn, but you're not getting the old Blake Griffin back either. He can do it in spurts. And lest we forget, this is from Kevin Durant's first full season back from the Achilles, and he went through other injuries this season. So you don't want to, you know, don't overburden him. You may not have a choice, there's going to be a lot on his shoulders if, in fact, Kyrie and Harden don't play again. And that's the thing. Like, we don't know. The boot could be just protective, preventative, whatever. Maybe he heals quickly. But, yeah, the boot's a bad sign for Kyrie. Harden, no indication that he's going to be back soon. If those two don't play again, I do not see how they get out of this series. The Bucks, for all of their perceived flaws, or perceived and real flaws, the Bucks are really freaking good. And they're on a roll right now. They've got their confidence back. If Giannis could just stop shooting pull-up threes and drive a little more, or, you know, pass to somebody who's better at making threes, like, they're going to be fine. P.J. Tucker's had some success getting into Durant and getting under his skin, making him less efficient the last couple of games. The Bucks have a clear path here now, I think, Chris. And they, you know, the Nets need Kyrie or Harden. They're not. I don't think they're getting out of the series without him.
And how about that the Bucks have a clear path here, not just to win the series, but maybe win a championship? I mean, I understand that luck goes into a lot of championship equations, whether it's the Houston Rockets in the mid-1990s collecting two championships, in part because Michael Jordan was not a presence in those 2 years, not in the NBA and not when he came back at the highest level. The Knicks, a championship team, championship-level team in the 90s, not getting that far in large part because of Jordan. Go down the list. I mean, circumstance affects everything. The Portland Trailblazers, the early 2000s, you can make countless lists. Like, a healthy Nets team might have swept Milwaukee. Like, the Nets, they're really friggin' good. Like, fully healthy, they might have just rolled through Milwaukee. They were about to roll through them even without James Harden, like, just with Irving and Durant in that mix. A healthy Irving and Durant, they probably win this series. Now, the Bucks look like they're in a great position to win the series. And if you kind of look at the landscape, no disrespect to Phoenix, the winner of the Phoenix-Utah series, Sixers-Hawks. I mean, if the Bucks aren't the favorite, they're at least 1A in that discussion. And like, how game-changing would that be for Milwaukee? I mean, they get battered in 4 or 5 games by the Bucks. There are sweeping changes in that organization. I don't know how Mike Budenholzer survive something like that. There might be trades that have to be made to shake things up. Now, you could have the start of something potentially big there that could end with that begins with a championship, rather, this season. I just think it's funny, like, how, you know, fate tends to determine a lot of these things, the outcome of these things.
Well, and legacies, right? We love talking about legacy in sports talk, right? But, like, legacies are made in part because of, you know, who was still standing at the end. If Giannis goes up against a completely healthy Nets team with Harden, Kyrie, and KD, yes, maybe it would have been a sweep. And now we're all talking again about, well, gee, do we want to rethink those two MVPs? And Budenholzer's out, and maybe the front office gets, you know, chipped away at, maybe the roster. Who knows what happens, right? Giannis has already signed the extension, so there's that. But still, there'd be all new pressure about, is this really where he should be? The questions and the consequences for getting swept by a fully healthy Nets team would have been profound. Instead, let's play this out. Let's say they come back, they win this series. Let's say they beat Philly, and they're in the finals at a minimum. But especially in the event that they win the championship, now it's Giannis's crowning achievement. Everything that came before, the two MVPs that people started to wonder about, whatever. Nope, totally vindicated. And not that it should work that way. You and I know that. But, like, that's the way these things get talked about. And suddenly he's certified. He's certified as a champion, and the details will fall away, and no one will care that the Nets were banged up or that Embiid was playing with a slightly torn meniscus. So, yes, like, everything can change because of that. Chris Paul, at the same time, like, you know, his career arc and his legacy, no one was going to doubt that he was a Hall of Famer, but it was always still going to be, he didn't make the finals, he didn't have a chance to win a championship, his career was incomplete as an all-timer. He's got a path now, too. And just getting to the finals will be something. Winning it all, certainly. It's not to get caught up in rings culture. It's just to say that everything, the context of the discussion around a guy changes once you've got that ultimate prize. And, you know, one or the other might be walking away with it in a few weeks.
No doubt. I mean, it's, nobody will remember the circumstance of the playoffs. They'll just remember if the Milwaukee Bucks can win a championship during it. All right, so be fun to watch. Howard, good stuff as always. We will do it again next week. But when we come back, my conversation with Cavs guard Colin Sexton. All right, Colin Sexton is here, Cleveland Cavaliers guard this summer. Hotels.com, the official travel partner of the NBA, has fans and travelers covered during the NBA Conference Finals presented by AT&T. Anytime a team hits 20 fast break points in a game, fans can score one night reward night, drop directly into their Hotels.com reward account to use their own fast break. Fans have 24 hours after the game ends to visit. You can go to www.hotels.com/fastbreakgetaway to claim their night. But you've got to be quick. Only the first 100 fans can snag this deal. So, Colin, how much of the playoffs have you been watching?
Just pretty much every game. I've been pretty much locked into the playoffs just because just pretty much watching how hard the guys are playing and how much the teams are competing. At the end of the day, I'm a competitor, so I like to watch how other teams compete and how they're doing the little things out there, and just how interesting each series is, because if one guy goes down, then it changed the whole dynamic of the series as well. So, or if certain guys aren't making shots, so it's a whole lot of things that play a factor. So I definitely watch the games and just pretty much study the games. I'm watching it and seeing what things I can improve on and some things that I can take away from other guys and put into my game. So that's how I watch it.
You know, when you watch the playoffs, you see it during the regular season, but in the playoffs, it gets magnified. Like the value of your position of playing point guard. Like it has been over the last 10, 15 years, the most important position in the NBA. And every night, and you know this, obviously you experience it, you're going up against somebody that's a borderline superstar in this league. I mean, do you ever look at the calendar and be like, man, I got like 7 straight days of Damian Lillard, Kyrie Irving, and Russell Westbrook?
Not really, pretty much. You see the guys and you just pretty much now you have to watch a lot of film on them like beforehand and just see what's been helping them, or if they're shooting the three ball pretty good. Maybe they say over the last 4, they're shooting 55% from the three. So you just got to pretty much know those things going into the game. So yeah, when you do like look at the calendar, you're not looking at it like that. You're looking at it, all right, now let me break down some film. Let me see what I can do to make sure that I'm ready for the game and be prepared.
Is there anybody you get geared up to play against though?
Not at all. Pretty much everybody. I like when I play against Chris Paul just because he was my coach. So I just pretty much and mentor. So I'll say Chris Paul just because I've been knowing him for a long time and just to have that relationship. So
who was the first time you matched up with Chris Paul? Who was it weirder for, you or him, to be, you know, former coach versus former player against each other?
It was probably him because he was like, he's 18, 19 years old, and you know what I mean? So it was probably more for him than it was for me.
What do you see, Colin, when you watch Chris Paul? I mean, a 36-year-old still playing at this level, probably has 3, maybe 4 good years left in him. I'm wondering what you see when you watch how his game has aged so well.
Oh man, I would say his confidence, how he's poised, how he can pretty much get to any shot he wants to, and no one can speed him up at all. I think he had like the 24 or 5 assists and 1 turnover just like a couple like days ago. Like just those things right there that people normally don't see, like just the little things, and how each team that he goes to, they win. You know what I mean? Everybody loves a winner. And at the end of the day, you're respected a lot more when you do win. And that's why everybody around the league respects him so much, is because of that.
Yeah, I think the last 2 years have been, you know, maybe the, I don't know if they're not statistically the best years of his career, but doing what he did with Oklahoma City and now doing what he did with Phoenix, like that's, as a team player, I would think that's the greatest testament to your success.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just because like he's coming in being a great locker room guy and just holding those guys accountable. You can definitely see it out there because he's being that dog out there and just getting onto his players and they're respecting it because like, all right, I got you. I'm going to do better. You can definitely tell like it's coming from a good place at the end of the day. So
when you first came into the NBA and these all these point guards that you grew up watching, maybe some of them building your game after, do you ever get starstruck early in a game, you're like, damn, I'm going up against this guy?
Not at all. Not at all. Just because I'm a competitor, at the end of the day, I compete just like you do. I tie my shoes up just like everybody else. So that's just how I was raised, and that's just how I think about it. At the end of the day, like, it's 0-0, and it's me against you. So that's it.
You talked earlier in this interview about kind of watching these games and learning some things. As you, over your career, as you've played against top guys, like, what are some of the things you have kind of pulled from other people's games and tried to incorporate into yours, which is what all the great players ultimately do. It's everybody kind of borrows from somebody else.
I would say just like Tony Parker. I watched Tony Parker getting in the lane and using the floater, being able to finish around the goal and not just having to be athletic, being able to stay on the ground and just use that. Chris Paul mid-range game, as well as Westbrook mid-range game, and just like being able to fly off, curl, pin downs like Bradley Beal, just different things like that that I just pick and choose from different people and just try to incorporate and go practice.
Chris Paul is so good with that kind of elbow jump shot moving in one direction. He's almost perfected it. But like, if you went to JB Bickerstaff and said, I want to shoot more mid-range jump shots, like, what is he going to say to you?
He's like, he said, if we're making them, all right, but if we're missing them, we got to think about something else.
It is. I mean, it's become almost taboo in the NBA to shoot that mid-range shot. But here we are in the playoffs with maybe the best point guard remaining, you know, knocking them down in clutch situations. I mean, what does that tell you about the game?
How at the NBA, like, people think of the three, it's just so important. It really is. But you can definitely tell, like, the mid-range game is really good as well, because if you're watching the game with Westbrook, he shoots a lot of mid-range. As those Bradley Beal shoots mid-range jumpers, like, certain guys still shoot the mid-range and use it for their advantage, like Devin Booker as well. So it's cool.
How do you approach the three-point shot, Colin? I mean, do you go into the next few years of your career thinking, I've got to get my attempts up, you know, and the way the game is going? Do you have to shoot more as your career goes forward?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You just got to make sure you're just ready to shoot them and just be confident in shooting them. At the end of the day, yeah, each and every year you want to get more attempts up and just improve on different things, maybe like coming down off pin downs, being able to shoot, or be better coming off the pick and roll with the ball, being able to shoot, like different things, a lot of catch and shoot. So different things that you work on the offseason that's going to help you transform your game.
When you watch these teams in the playoffs and the intensity, I mean, how much does that, if at all, kind of motivate you to get yourself, get your team to that level?
Oh, it definitely motivates me a whole lot, just because that's where we want to get to. And that's where we want to be. We want to be one of those teams playing in the playoffs. We want to be one of those teams where it's game seven and all right, it's win or go home type situation. So.
Do you have confidence? Yeah, it's been a rough 3 years record-wise for you in Cleveland. Do you have confidence Cleveland is on a path to get there?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like we have a really young core, and we'll be fine. Last year, we had a lot of injuries, and a lot of guys missed a lot. But I know coming up, we're going to all make sure our bodies are good so that we can just continue to have a good season. And we try to make sure that we limit those little aches and pains here and there so we can go to the playoffs, you know what I mean? So.
The chemistry with a backcourt partner is obviously incredibly important. We've seen great chemistry. We've seen not so great chemistry across the league. What do you think of your chemistry with Darius, not just in how it's been, but what it can be? Do you believe in that dynamic moving forward?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I definitely do. It's gotten better over the year, and we just continue to get better, especially towards the end of the season. We was pretty much rolling together and understanding that where each other likes the ball or even just likes to be in situation or what plays. So we just pretty much was feeding off each other, and we started having some really good success.
What areas did it improve last year? What did you see?
Just pretty much a lot of plays off of each other. Maybe if he calls some plays for me to curl to the basket and they jump to me, man, I can just spray it out to him, kickball in like a three, just like different things like that. Or just like dribble handoffs, and if they go under, like using my speed to race them to the basket, like different things like that, that we just pretty much started to realize, all right, they're doing this. So maybe if you make them drive to the right and then cut them off. And then once he spins, I'm going to try to come get the steal, different things like that, that helped a whole lot.
Last question on basketball for you. You're extension eligible this summer. Are you anxious about that? How are you approaching this offseason when it comes to your future with Cleveland?
I'm just approaching it like I normally would, normal season, just continue to get better at the end of the day. And I know I was up there in Cleveland last week, and just the camaraderie, the team togetherness that we had. We went out to eat, went to Topgolf, different things like that. That's looking really good for the future for us. And I'm excited. I'm definitely excited to be in Cleveland.
So you're hoping something gets done long term this summer?
Yes. It doesn't matter. I'm just excited at the end of the day. I know Cleveland is the place I want to be in. I know we have something going as a young team. I know we got J.A., Isaac, and Darius, and we got K-Love, and Vets. And so I definitely look forward to it for sure.
So I see you're, as you're promoting Hotels.com, you're doing this interview in a robe. Is that purposeful there? Is that intentional?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. I feel like everyone should at least be following the games and follows the series. Like you said earlier, 20 or more fast break points, you get a free trip. So, but you have to make sure you're the first 100. So make sure you go visit Fast Break Getaway page on hotels.com. That's a must. So make sure you go do that. Who doesn't like a vacation? I know you probably do.
You're damn right I do.
Absolutely.
I want to get to a point, Colin, where I can walk around in a robe all day. Like, you can do it. I know Kevin Love can do it. Kevin Love probably does it on a regular basis, but I want to get to that point.
Kevin Love definitely does it, especially probably during the offseason. Kevin's probably somewhere nice outside.
I bet he is. Colin, good luck with the rest of the offseason. Hope it all works out for you in Cleveland. And thanks for joining me, man.
Thank you. I appreciate it.